a gun in the face.
Then all of a sudden, they all kind of lined up. They pointed their guns at me. And this is the point where I thought, I'm going to die today.
Started 2 years of horror for an American in Venezuela.
They said, you need to give us your phone and get ready because you're coming with us.
I'm Becky Bruce, and I spent a year researching and piecing together Josh and Tammy Holt's story about their ordeal in a notorious prison.
That's when everything started to turn bad. We had another pound on the door. Boom, boom, boom. And there was the police once again.
You can binge all of the episodes of Hope and Darkness on KSLPodcasts.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Inside Sources.
Inside Sources.
America's voice of reason. Boyd Matheson on Utah's home for elevated conversation. Inside Sources on KSL News Radio.
Well, in January, of course, the media, the pundits, the politicians all cried that catastrophe was imminent, that the U.S. needed to raise the debt ceiling, and if they didn't, it would be an economic disaster. For months, there's been hand-wringing, fear-mongering, all kinds of blaring headlines. But over the last few hours, late into the night last night, before the deadline, before Armageddon hit, the Senate passed the debt ceiling and spending agreement and sent it to President Biden's desk and avoided default. After all the stark warnings, all the hand-wringing, all the fake fights, false choices, scare tactics, it all seemed just a little bit anticlimactic. But there's a lesson in there. It's not about the making of mayhem and this kind of confusion. The lesson is, how do we actually deconstruct debt ceilings and deficit spending? Let's begin.
Think you know the news of the day? Think again with Boyd Matheson on KSL News Radio.
Well, when you have these kind of Armageddon moments, that end of the world as we know it, and all the catastrophes that were touted and fear-mongered, it's important to not just let the moment pass. That's what politicians are hoping, is that everyone says, oh, catastrophe averted, continue on with your regularly scheduled programming. And away everyone else goes into summer. I think the important thing for us to do is to deconstruct this a little bit, figure out how we got to this point, why we got out of it, and more importantly, what to watch for when we see this movie again, because it will come. And the reruns will be worse than the original. And so we have to look at all of that. And you'll recall back in January when really everyone started sounding the alarm bells, we said on this program, put your panic button away. Social Security checks are going to go out. Military is going to get paid. There was no part along the way that this was anything more than manufactured crisis and politics at its worst, not the country at its best. And so I wanted to deconstruct it because we went through the process. We talked about it over the last several months in terms of what was going to happen. There was, of course, over 100 days where nothing happened. The House had passed a bill. The Senate had done nothing. The president waited. Then finally they had a meeting. Then it went to staff. Then it came back to the principals in the room with Speaker McCarthy and President Biden. Then there were a very select few number of negotiators. Those broke off, came back on, another meeting, and on we've gone all the way until here we are. The president's going to sign the bill, and away we go. Now, did anything really change? No. Did we make great advancement? No, not even close. But we have to step back and say, okay, now what was that? What just happened and what didn't happen and why? So I not only want to go back to January, where we said, this is not happening, no panic button required, and watch the process roll out. I want to go back even further. First, I want to go back to December of last year. December of last year, Congress had not done its job to fund the government. Right before Christmas, as is usually the case, because that's the best time to get people to buckle and to buy in and sign off on spending before they race off to the Christmas holidays. And they did. And remember, at that point in the program, the Democrats were in charge of the House, the Senate, and the White House. And they put together what's called an omnibus spending package. Big, massive bill nobody reads, done in the dead of night, extends spending and throws in all kinds of little Christmas ornaments and little gifts for everyone along the way. It's a lot of spending. And it keeps everything rolling. There was an opportunity right there, right then, to increase the debt ceiling. And the Democrats, in control of all three, passed. They said, nah, we'll kick this can down the road. We'll deal with it in the spring. We know we have probably until about June to get this done, so we'll just kick the can. And the can got kicked. Now, unless you think that is just a finger-pointing at what the Democrats did not do in December, let's ratchet back just a little bit further. Because where this really began, this whole crisis that we watched unfold over the last several months and over the last few weeks, really began in September of 2022, when Congress once again chose not to do its job to fund the government with 12 appropriations bills coming out of committee, voted on the floor of the House, voted on the floor of the Senate, and sent to the president to fund the government. So that's where this round really began. It was all the way back over a year ago when Congress, for I don't know how many consecutive years now, has not done their job. There are so few jobs that Congress has as outlined in the Constitution. Funding the government's a pretty big deal. And it's really simple. There's 12 appropriations bills. What does that mean? Those are the ways that we fund the military, the way we fund social programs, the way we fund education, and on it goes. There's 12 of them. Work on those are supposed to begin every spring. Members of Congress are assigned to committees. They're expected to go to committee meetings and have hearings, debate the issues, and put forward an appropriations bill to fund that portion of the government. And then all of that is supposed to be completed by the time they get to September 30th, because the government's fiscal year begins on October the 1st. But last year, as has been the case under both Republicans and Democrats alike, for decades now, they've not done their job. And so the crisis that we were dealing with that wasn't going to happen because the United States has never defaulted on its payments, and it won't, and it didn't, is because Congress keeps spending and Congress doesn't do its job in terms of proper funding. And so it's this vicious cycle that we continue to go through. But the problem is the moment the crisis is over, everybody exhales, all the politicians leave town and go on a break. And then we're into summer and then we're back into the fall. And of course, fall is campaign season. And so we continue to perpetuate the problem. The real leadership we need is for someone to say, we need to stay in session and we need to get these things done so that we're not doing this in September. And this is where I put both a spoiler alert and a warning of a false warning. And so I want all of you to enjoy your summer vacations. I want you to have a fantastic time. And then I want you to remember, when you get back after Labor Day, a headline you will see is Congress only has 3 weeks to avoid a government shutdown. And there'll be scary music and the gravelly voice guy will come on and all of the cable news channels will talk about what catastrophes will happen to the country if the government is not funded by September, the end of September. And we're going to do this same dance, slightly different version, again in September. And so I want everyone to just recognize that we're just seeing this in repeat. And sometimes the leading actors and actresses change. Sometimes the voices are a little different. But we keep doing the same thing. And that is the very definition of insanity. And most of these catastrophes, calamities, whatever you want to call it, are manufactured And what we need to do as citizens and what we need to demand of our politicians is to deconstruct that. And it all begins when Congress decides to do their job.
Think again on Inside Sources with Boyd Matheson.
Two friends taking pictures of the rising full moon on a summer night.
Two teenage kids doing what teenage kids do.
When a stranger with a gun and a death wish changed everything.
It was violent, it was senseless, and I will never understand it, I will never accept it.
I'm Amy Donaldson, and unfortunately, we're all too familiar with stories about how violence shatters lives. But what we rarely see is how they are rebuilt. In a new podcast, The Letter, we relive tragedy, but only so we can hear the rest of the story. The struggle to reclaim lives, the realities of grief, and the possibilities of forgiveness.
I believe in miracles. Sometimes I thought, there are no miracles. Yeah, there are, and this is a big one.
Follow The Letter at theletterpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Boyd Matheson divides rage from reason on Inside Sources.
We're going to take a little step off of the beaten path. We often say that the road less traveled is the road best traveled. And often when we're dealing with friends or family or loved ones or colleagues and something has gone wrong, they're hurting, a death in the family, a loss of a job, a relationship ends, whatever it might be, we do have this innate desire or urge to fix it, to solve it, to make it better. And I think we often hear echoing in our heads maybe something our mothers yelled at us when we were little, to don't just stand there, do something. And sometimes the right answer to help somebody in need might be to not do something, stand there. And we're going to break all of that down and look at some interesting things over the next two segments. So you want to stick around for a crucial conversation, an enlightened conversation with our good friend Rabbi Joe Charnas, who is a Jewish teacher and scholar devoted to interfaith dialogue and engagement, joining us from California. And Rabbi Joy, thanks for coming back on the show.
Thanks for having me, Boyd. Appreciate it.
And so as we start this whole thing, and you've experienced this in so many different settings, we do have this natural inclination to just want to fix things or to solve it or to say it will be okay. You shared with me a couple of weeks ago something from Job that I think a lot of us miss. We always think of all of the problems, the challenges, the trials that Job has, but there's some pretty interesting lessons in terms of how do you help someone going through those trials?
Yeah, that was a beautiful conversation, and thank you for wanting to revisit it with a broader audience so we can all hopefully learn what Job has to offer us. And Job, the book of Job, not many people read, or they don't read it deeply. And Job is a genuine masterpiece, not because I am Jewish and it's part of my Bible. Victor Hugo, Carlyle, Tennyson, They speak of Job in the most exalted manner, that it is one of the greatest poem ever written when understood fully and broadly. And it applies to all of us as human beings, regardless of our faith, tradition, or background. And one thing that I can offer from the Jewish tradition, I do speak obviously through the prism of the Jewish faith, but I hope I speak in a way that we as human beings can all relate to. The details in Job are often remembered and they're reflected upon. But in Judaism, the details of the story are not simply describing. They're not simply the descriptive. They're also prescriptive. This is how I think, broadly speaking, Judaism often reads a text. The details are there. Yes, but they're directives, and they are guiding us how we can walk through life more fully. And so in this story of Job, in the second chapter, the friends of Job come to visit him from afar, and he's suffered all of the plagues and the loss of his family and his fortune, and he is in dire, dire straits. So in chapter 2, verse 11 through 13,
It speaks of Job's friends hearing. I'll just read it from everybody likes the ESV translation, but it speaks of Job's three friends heard of all the evil or the suffering that had come upon him, and they came, each from his own place. His three friends, Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar. But what's interesting here is that they came. They didn't just come to visit him. They came each, in the Hebrew, from his own place. They each have a place that they are coming from.
Right.
And this is critical for us when we are going to another person.
Mm.
How can I come to a person? I'm not going. I am coming from a place. And I am going to another place right now for this person who is in loss, for a person who is suffering. But the first and most important, I think, detail and instructive aspect of the story is that they came, each person from his own place, and when they came, they came to show sympathy and comfort. And that word for sympathy in the Hebrew is it's not a very clear word in terms of its usage, but we have a sense. And it one dimension has to do with showing the sympathy for him, to comfort him. The word sympathy doesn't actually capture what aspect of the verb is trying to convey, which is they were coming shaking their heads, is one nuance of the verb. They were in such shock, such horror at what they saw, at what they heard. And that's the critical, I think, step in coming to another person to help them and comfort them.
Yeah.
And then in verse 12, and we often miss that. We simply come and we show up.
Right.
But they're coming with disbelief, with shock, with pain, with angst. That's how we have to come to another person who is in that same place so that we can be with them. Not say anything, just be with them.
Right.
And when they saw him from a distance is the language. They saw him from a distance. Well, it could mean they saw him far away. They saw he was far, and they saw him, and they didn't recognize him. That's the language.
Yeah.
I think a deeper sense is trying to be conveyed here is that, of course, they recognized him. They knew who he was. It's Job, their friend. But he was unrecognizable because of his sorrow, his loss, his pain.
Right.
And so they are coming to him. He's not recognizable because he is now distanced from who he is. And our goal in comfort is simply to come back to the person where they are, not to say anything, to come where they are. And briefly, it says next that they tore their garments, they raised their voice, and they sat on the ground with him for 7 days and seven nights, and no one spoke a word. So the key thought I'll leave you with in this portion is when they came to him, they sat. They didn't speak. Mm. They sat.
That's so important.
And the word there for, it is, Boyd, you're right. And the word for with, there are a few words in Hebrew for with, and there is a debate over this word. This word, according to some commentators, is a deep identifying withness, an intimate withness. And that's what it's conveying to us. When we go to a person who is in grief, we can just sit there. But are we with them? Are we dwelling with them, or are we simply functionally there?
Right.
I'm going to
have you pause right there, Rabbi. Listeners that are just joining us, we're with Rabbi Joe Charnas. We're talking about this, how we actually are with people, especially those that might be in grief or struggling or having a difficulty of some sort. We've been looking at the example from the Bible of Job and so many important lessons there in terms of the friends that they came. They came from their own place. I think that's an important thing for us to keep in mind as we interact with us. We come from a place. I love the fact that the three friends made an appointment together. I think that's what ministering looks like. You're actually coming intentionally. It was purposefully. It wasn't just, maybe we'll show up because we have an extra minute. It was very intentional. And then that they were with him. And we're going to pick up on this when we come back from the break. We're going to continue our conversation with Rabbi Joe Charnas because that is what we do. We're going to stay with the conversation, and we're going to get into this essence of what it means to just be with someone and to give them one of the most important things we can, our presence, our full attention. Stay with us. More coming up with Rabbi Joe Charnas on Inside Sources on KSL News Radio. We'll be right back.
Inside Sources.
Inside Sources.
America's voice of reason. Boyd Matheson.
On Utah's home for elevated conversation.
Inside Sources on KSL News Radio.
Welcome back to Inside Sources. We're staying with the conversation just a little bit longer. Remember, Einstein, I think, said it best, that it wasn't that he was any smarter than anyone else. It's just that he was willing to stay with the question a little longer. And we're staying with the question. This whole idea of the need or the desire we have to fix things when we have a neighbor in need or a friend with a problem or a discouraging situation, whatever it might be, we want to fix. We want to fix. But what we really need to do is step back and be present, and everything starts to change from there. So we're going to continue our conversation with Rabbi Joe Charnas, a Jewish teacher and scholar devoted to interfaith dialogue and engagement, and someone that I look to have elevated conversations on a wide range of things. And Rabbi Joe, just before the break, we had gone through Job, and most people, regardless of faith tradition, know about Job and all that he lost and the trials and tests that he faced. And we've been going through this scenario where his three friends come to comfort him. And we were just going through the fact, one, they came from afar. They were in tune enough to know they were needed there. And then they came, and I want to get into what they did when they actually got there. They didn't say, "You're going to be okay, you got this." They did something quite different.
Yes, they did. Yes, they did. And to lead into that, when they came to him from afar, each from his own place, the critical, I think, detail that must be instructive for us, we must highlight this detail, is that each one came from his own place. I think the Bible here is trying to highlight for us that we each have a place to come from that can bring something to another person. But we have to be rooted in our place. We have to have grounding.
Yeah.
That's his or her own place. And they came together to show sympathy and to shake their heads and comfort. But they didn't. How often when we see a person, they're not recognizable. That's the beauty of verse 12. They saw him from a distance, and they didn't recognize him because Job wasn't in his place. He was right. Uprooted from life. And so he was distanced from himself, so they couldn't recognize him in his former glory. And we'll skip over the dust and the tearing of the robes, but they sat with him. And again, according to some commentators, that word for sitting with. Is intimate withness, not sitting by, but with. But notice what they didn't do, as you said. They didn't say, he's in a better place, or they're in a better place, or God wouldn't give you a test that you can't withstand, or it's all going to turn out for the best. Those may all be true. But at this point in time, all they did was, in verse 12, they raised their voices. They wept, they tore their robes, and they sprinkled dust over their heads towards heaven and sat on the ground with him for 7 days and seven nights. Judaism has the tradition of mourning by sitting on the ground for 7 days and seven nights, because symbolically, again, that's the detail, but the symbolism behind that is we can't go any lower.
Yeah,
that's the directive for us to face that. And what happens next is always the problem for us. I'm sitting with you, and what do I say? So the beautiful, beautiful insight from Job chapter 2, verse 13, this last little section of the Three Friends episode, as far as the intro at least, they sat with him on the ground for 7 days and seven nights, and no one spoke a word to him. And they saw, and it gives a reason, They saw that his suffering was very great. The goal for all of us, we have noble hearts, compassionate hearts, wanting to help. We want to help. The problem is words aren't the way.
Yeah.
The text here is simply, they sat with, deeply with him, in silence and in sorrow. And the key word there is with.
Yeah.
So silence. That says everything. That says it all, because there's nothing we can say. But I am here by sitting with you.
Yeah. And listen, I want to expand that out now a little bit in terms of kind of how we do that day to day. I think that sitting with and saying nothing, I think those two components in and of itself, we could spend weeks just on that element in and how that plays out in our daily lives. If we really are with people and we're willing to be still and be silent with people, that's where we can actually do the most good, because I'm still convinced that one of the most holy and sacred things we can give to another person is that being with, being totally present, giving full attention to. Help us kind of broaden this out now, Rabbi, in terms of how this applies to all of us in terms of being present with the people around us.
Beyond the immediate context of mourning and grieving, now it's just broad withness. Simply being with another person wherever they are, in their place, presence. So I would use the word presence. How can we be present? I think it's a beautiful way of understanding the word presence is through the prism of the Hebrew language. One of the Hebrew words for presence, biblically speaking, actually is your face. It's face, F-A-C-E. The word face in Hebrew is presence. In fact, there's a verse in the book of Exodus in chapter 33 when God speaks to Moses and he says, he doesn't say, I will go with you and give you rest. He says literally, I don't know how they do it in English, but I'm telling you literally, it says, Ponai, my face, or my face is literally, will go, they will go with you. So, the first key right here for all of us is how often are we even facing another person?
Right.
My presence is almost always obvious by my face, Am I facing you?
Yeah.
If I'm not facing you, either outwardly or certainly within my inner face, there's no presence. But if my face will go with you, that's my presence. And in the Aramaic translation of that, we didn't get to go, we're not going into deep theology here, but the Aramaic translation of that language of my face, of the language my face, uses the word for, in English, they say it's Shekinah, right? The glorious presence, the indwelling presence of God. That's the Aramaic translation in this context of face, because that's the glorious presence.
Yeah.
How can we bring our glorious presence to another person simply by facing them, by seeing their face, by seeing their glory, by understanding there is another person before me? You're not faceless. You are a face, you are a person. And how can we begin to connect with each other? And how can my face go with you? Not can I walk with you, but how can my face, my presence, be with you? It's a wonderful meditation, I think, that will help us face each other more fully.
I love that. I love that. Rabbi Joe Charnas, Jewish teacher and scholar, devoted to interfaith dialogue and engagement. We're going to continue this conversation over the next couple of weeks, because I think this is one where we get so sideways so fast, and if we can't be present with people, if we can't really turn our face toward them and be with them, it's really hard to get any of to those meaningful places and spaces in terms of dialogue, connection, and helping everyone move to higher ground. Rabbi Joe, thank you so much for joining us on a Friday. Shabbat shalom to you,
thank you.
Into the Sabbath.
Look forward to it.
And we look
forward to
having you back soon. All right, that's Rabbi Joe Charnas. We'll go ahead and take a quick break. When we come back, we'll continue on a Friday here on Inside Sources on KSL News Radio. Stick around. We'll be right back.
Inside Sources, an inside look at 2024 presidential politics.
Well, it's that time of the week. It's our weekly deep dive into presidential politics. As we always preface this segment, trying to understand the behavior of someone running for president is like trying to smell the color 7. Noodle on that. If you're driving along, don't crash. Obviously, a lot happening with people running for president. And a lot of times you just can't figure out what they're thinking or what they're striving to do. But we're going to try to help you navigate all of that as we go through this, what will be a very interesting presidential cycle. And, of course, this week, even more Republicans either jumped in or are preparing to jump in or are talking about jumping in. And, of course, we anticipate that early next week, the former Vice President Mike Pence and New Jersey Governor Chris Christie are expected to make formal announcements as we roll into the week next week. Joe Biden, of course, made his formal announcement and has not done anything campaign-wise since. So we have no sound to share with the president from the campaign trail because he has not stepped foot upon it. He's been doing a lot of Rose Garden politicking, as they like to say, doing events in the Rose Garden. So it looks more like governing than it does politics. But a lot of those messages are being said, sent, and we'll break those down as we go. And so now that we've got some things in the rearview mirror as it relates to the governing portion of the job, we've got the debt ceiling and spending bill done. The president will sign that today or early tomorrow. He's going to speak to the nation later today. You can listen to snippets of that as that comes out later here on KSL News Radio. But let's jump into where are we? And earlier this week, we had our friend Carly Cooperman, CEO of Schoen Cooperman Research, one of the great polling organizations in the country. We were talking about some of the primary challengers on the Democratic side of the aisle. Obviously, President Biden goes in with a big war chest. It goes in with all the structure that goes with being the president of the United States. And it was interesting, as you look at some of those in the race already on the Democratic side, some are polling quite well when it comes to favorability, especially compared to the president. Here's what Carly Cooperman had to say about what those poll numbers might mean in terms of their chances against the president.
While I don't think these Democratic primary challengers pose a serious threat at this point, he's got to be careful because if it gets to the point where they can get enough support and energy and attention, the last thing that Biden wants to do is be in a position where he has to debate them and really give air and, you know, fuel to their candidates.
So really important there. I think Carly's right in terms of what threat they really are. These numbers are pretty interesting. In that they have very high favorabilities and they're polling quite well. And as we always say, it's not about the polls at this point. It's about the process. It's organizing, it's fundraising, and it's messaging. And that will be the test. So one of those challenging the president is Robert F. Kennedy Jr. Let's go to what he said this week during an interview with Neil Cavuto. He gave his reasonings as to why he's running against a sitting president and friend of the Kennedy family, Joe Biden.
Ultimately, I'm in a much better position to beat Donald Trump than Joe Biden is. I also just disagree with him on basic issues like my father did with Lyndon Johnson. I think what we're doing in this war is unnecessarily prolonging it and unnecessarily hiking up the bloodshed. I disagree with that. I disagree with some of the public health policies of this administration. So I think, you know, like my dad ran on principle, he did not believe that he could win. And his objective was to tell the truth to the American people, and that's what I'm going to do. And if there's an appetite for that, I'll be in the White House in 2025.
So very interesting insight there from Robert F. Kennedy Jr. as to why he's in the race against the sitting president of his own party. And again, longtime family friend there for the Kennedy clan. And just really interesting, though, I really appreciate Robert F. Kennedy Jr. talking about how his father went about the race, not worried about whether or not he would win, but that he was determined to run on principle, that he was going to tell the truth. And if there's an appetite for that, then the winning takes care of itself. That's actually a fantastic message from Robert F. Kennedy Jr. for everyone across the political spectrum. That if you run on principle and you tell the truth, and there's an appetite for that, you win. And that's the only way you really win and get to lead. You can win a campaign with a whole lot of promises and a whole lot of vibrato and a whole lot of deception and distraction, but that doesn't mean you get to lead. That doesn't mean you get to be a real steward of the country. or whatever the particular office is. I think that's an important one. We're going to put a pin in that one with Robert F. Kennedy Jr. I think that's an important message that we're going to come back to over the course of the campaign, and we will be equal opportunity offender and commender to those who run that kind of race on principle, telling the truth that leads to good policy, and then the voters get to decide. All right, let's jump over to the Republican side of the aisle now. Obviously, a lot of folks getting in. We mentioned those who are expected to get in the coming days. One of the newer entrants, of course, is the governor of Florida, Ron DeSantis, during a recent speech in Iowa. Governor DeSantis decided to stop staying quiet in responses to attacks that were being leveled from the former president, Donald Trump. And here's what he had to say about the former president.
He used to say how great Florida was. His whole family moved to Florida under my governorship. Are you kidding me? It's also the case that we won the biggest election landslide that Florida Republicans have ever won. And did he ever say anything like, good job? No, he attacked me 3 days before the midterm election. And so I'm just thinking to myself, as a Florida resident, I would be cheering for that. If you put the mission first, you would definitely be cheering for that.
So an interesting component, mission first. I think you're going to hear that more from Governor DeSantis. I think that's going to be a line that they'll continue to test as they go through the summer. And then as you get to the fall and things get into a little sharper focus, I think you'll see some messaging around that mission first idea, of course, with the Governor DeSantis and his military background. We'll continue to watch. It's really interesting. We'll have this 100 days basically from now until Labor Day, and then when things get back, there will be the first of the Republican debates will take place in August in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And that's going to be a very interesting one. We'll have a whole host of Republicans on the stage. It might be very reminiscent of 2016. You'll have U.N. Ambassador Nikki Haley. The former vice president will be in by then. South Carolina Senator Tim Scott will be there. Former Arkansas Governor Asa Hutchinson, who made some very interesting comments during the course of the week in terms of why he's running and why that matters. You've got Michigan businessman Perry Johnson. You got author Vivek Ramaswamy, and of course, former California gubernatorial candidate Larry Elder. So the group is growing, and that's going to create some interesting dynamics and challenges. So we saw that in 2016 in terms of who gets voice and what do you have to do to get attention. And that's the challenge. And so as we move into next week, we're going to shift gears a little bit. And we always talk about process because process matters. And the process that's going to be most important for all of these candidates on both sides of the aisle over the next 100 days is going to come down to, can they fundraise? Can they organize? Can they get people on the ground in the critical spaces? And then can they get the right message that will break through and be heard by the American people after Labor Day? All right, well, that wraps up our special section we do every Friday here on Inside Sources. We take our inside look at presidential politics. And that also rounds out hour number one of Inside Sources. We'll step aside for some top of the hour news, but don't go anywhere. Much more to come on Inside Sources here on KSL News Radio. We'll be right back.
KSL FM Midvale, KSL Salt Lake City. Listen on the KSL News Radio app and in your car at 102.7 FM. KSL News Radio, your all-day companion for news. Inside Sources.
Inside Sources.
America's voice of reason. Boyd Matheson.
On Utah's home for elevated conversation.
Inside Sources on KSL News Radio.
Well, this weekend, the Republican presidential candidates are going to be in Iowa for the most part, participating in the annual Roast and Ride event, opportunity to ride some motorcycles and do some grilling with Senator Joni Ernst and others across the state of Iowa. Of course, they're attempting to boost their presence for that critical early Iowa caucus. Iowa is, of course, important to those all the candidates, but the second tier candidates, so to speak, often have a difficult chance in terms of breaking through. Iowa's a place where they often can. And we want to look in this segment to look at how do we actually see that happening? What does that look like? Many, of course, are focused on the broad polling numbers, which show more of the former president and the current governor of Florida as the top tier. But we know that it's not just the polls, especially at this point in the game. There's some other really crucial factors that will determine if anyone can break through, catch momentum, or even ride a wave all the way into the White House. Michael Warren's a senior editor for The Dispatch, and a great piece talking about how some of these candidates on the Republican side can actually have a strategy to break through. And Michael, thanks for joining us today.
Boyd, thanks so much for having me.
So let's dig into this. Obviously, you have those that are polling at the top. The former president, the current governor of Florida, are up there. But let's get underneath. What are the keys to the strategy for those who are trying to break through and maybe become that potential leading candidate?
Well, you know, Boyd, I talked to a lot of Republican strategists who have been there, who have done this before, and it's still early, but it's still requires, you know, some actual action from these candidates. I call them the also-runnings. They've got quite a busy summer. The next couple of months are going to be crucial for these guys. And I sort of break it down into three different benchmarks that they really have to start trying to meet. The first is obviously fundraising. Mm-hmm. They've got to raise enough money. You know, you've got Donald Trump and Ron DeSantis who have really got enough money to go the distance, and they will have the ability, if they continue to do well, if they continue to poll well, to keep getting those precious fundraising dollars. So if you want to break through and challenge DeSantis and Trump, you've got to raise money. The second thing is the organizing and the pressing the flesh, really, in the early states. You mentioned the roast and ride in Iowa. A number of candidates and soon-to-be candidates are going to be there this weekend. New Hampshire is obviously the other state you've got to be at. You've also got to be sort of finding your precinct captains, the people who you're going to rely on, particularly in Iowa, to get people out at those caucuses. And then finally, of course, is prepping for those debates. And the first one, which we expect to be in August in Milwaukee, sponsored by the RNC, you got to sort of build the foundation with those first two and then use that moment, which may just be one moment if you're, you know, polling at less than 1%, that moment in the debate to make an impression on a national audience that will drive how people view you, even in those early states like Iowa and New Hampshire and beyond.
Yeah, and that's so important. It's that it is that moment. It's that tap on the shoulder moment. You don't know when it's coming, but you better be ready and you better be prepared. Opportunity always favors the prepared. And so let's dig into some of these things. And you did such a beautiful job with this in your piece at the Dispatch today. And I encourage people to go check that out. It's where we always go for just solid analysis, great reporting, and it's great writing, which is becoming a lost art in the world today. But in your piece there, let's talk about the fundraising component to it. You mentioned the big dollars that, of course, the former President Trump and Ron DeSantis have right now. Go to that next level of running. What do the dollars and cents look like for those candidates?
Well, you know, Tim Scott, the senator from South Carolina, is in somewhat of a different category than the other second-tier candidates. He ran for office in 2022 for re-election to the Senate. He didn't really have a Democratic opponent that threatened him. He won overwhelmingly, I think something like almost 60% of the vote in South Carolina. And what did he come out with? He came out with $22 million of federal money raised under federal fundraising rules that he can just use in his presidential campaign. So he's got an advantage there. He's also got a super PAC that's being backed by some untold amount of money from Larry Ellison, one of the richest men in the world, co-founder of Oracle. And so he's in maybe a different category, and his team really thinks they have the money to go the distance. After that, it gets a little unclear. You've got Nikki Haley, who's been in the race as a candidate since February. She's raised some money, but maybe not quite enough. It's something a little over $8 million she's got across a couple of committees and her campaign. And she's really, I think that's the candidate we're going to want to watch at the end of June when those second quarter of 2023 reports come out. Is she raising the right amount of money? I saw her actually earlier this week. She was speaking at a Connecticut state party event. I asked her team, well, you know, what's she doing in Connecticut? Not really a early primary state. Of course, she was meeting also with donors in the New York area, in New York and Connecticut. That's something she's going to have to work on. And then beyond that, it's just really a big question. Does Mike Pence have some wealthy benefactors who back a super PAC that can support him in Iowa? What about small dollar donors, you know, getting those internet dollars, essentially, that Democrats and Donald Trump have been very good at getting? That's the kind of thing that you can watch and kind of gauge whether or not there's a groundswell of support for maybe some of these other candidates. Vivek Ramaswamy is one who is leaning into that. So that's the sort of fundraising story I'll be watching.
Yeah, and then let's look just real quickly at kind of the press, the flesh component. You got to get you got to one connect with the people, and then you got to get the right people. You got to get those precinct chairs. You got to get people on the ground in all of those districts and so on. How is that playing out? That's an interesting area. Of course, President Trump was known for the big rallies. Governor DeSantis has had a little less than stellar track record in terms of the meet and greet and grip and grin component to campaigning. Who has the advantages there, especially looking at Iowa, New Hampshire, and South Carolina?
You know, it's an important aspect of it. It is one of those things that's probably necessary, but not sufficient in order to do well. At the end of the day, people in Iowa and New Hampshire have TVs. They have the internet. They're sort of influenced by the things that all the rest of us Americans are influenced by. But at the same time, it is an important part of what these candidates, again, can build on. And this is a question, you know, there was a bit of a kerfuffle about Ron DeSantis kind of snapping at a reporter in New Hampshire earlier this week, who was asking, why aren't you going to take questions from voters? And DeSantis sort of said, I'm standing here right now talking to voters. But there was something a little deeper in that question, which was he hasn't had one of those town hall events, which are a very kind of particular type of event in New Hampshire, that in both parties, primary voters are kind of come to expect candidates to stand up there, take hard questions, get in almost a back and forth. I've seen it over several presidential cycles that I've covered. That's something that DeSantis hasn't committed to yet. He's probably going to have to if he wants to do well. It's the kind of thing that voters in New Hampshire, very sophisticated, kind of come to expect. Yeah. You also look real quickly at Iowa. The social conservative base there, that's something that people like Tim Scott and Mike Pence are really looking at as do or die. That's their base. They want to perform really well there, and that's going to require being in front of people and being familiar.
Yeah, great insight. And we know that over the next 100 days, there will be a lot of that last component you mentioned, which is kind of the message testing and preparing for a breakthrough moment. And we'll continue to watch that. I think you'll hear a lot of message testing over the summer, all gearing towards, as you mentioned, Michael, that debate in Milwaukee post Labor Day in August, when that or just as we get to Labor Day there towards the end of August, that that'll be the kind of the next step for all of that. Michael Warren, grateful to have you on the program today. Great insight as always. Senior editor for the Dispatch. We look forward to having you back to continue the conversation as we move this all forward.
Thank you, Boyd.
All right, that's Michael Warren from the Dispatch. And so many things candidates have to do. You got to raise the money. You got to connect with the people. You got to get a message that's going to break through all the noise. And that's the big test. We'll continue to watch it. More Inside Sources coming up next.
Hear elevated conversation on crucial issues. Boyd Matheson on Inside Sources.
Well, welcome back to Inside Sources here on KSL News Radio. Great to be with you on a Friday, as it is every day. I am Boyd Matheson. And as we round out the week, as we come to an end of graduation season, of course, we're always looking for some of those inspiring moments. And we actually had one at Sky Ridge High School. Principal John Walwork gave just an inspiring, very emotional speech. Someone who's been in the business of education for well over 24 years. And I want to go to some of the things that he said, and who he called out is so important, and how he did it that I think was really inspiring. So we want to close out our week with a few little clips here. So we want to start with, again, Sky Ridge Principal John Walwork. He began by saying that he's learned more from his students than they've learned from him.
Sky Ridge community, this is my 24th year in education. The reason I got into this was so that I could make a positive impact on the lives of young people. What I've learned after 24 years is the exact opposite. That these young people have had a tremendous impact on my life.
I love that. And then he went into some very compelling stories of students. The first student he called out was Jenny from Haiti. Listen to her story.
First, Jenny Juassain, please stand. Born in Haiti and raised there till the age of 15, Jenny's parents made a difficult decision to remove her from Haiti's danger and unrest and sent her to the safety of the U.S. with Amethyst, a trusted friend here in Lehi. Jenny arrived here not speaking any English, only Creole and French. As she hasn't been back to Haiti nor seen her parents and siblings since she left 3 years ago. While here, Jenny has thrived, participating in track, dance, choir, French. She's taken a number of AP courses. Jenny received a scholarship to attend Utah Valley University, where she plans to major in engineering, French, and dance. Jenny's dream is to open up dance studios in third world countries for disadvantaged kids who otherwise couldn't afford dance classes. Jenny, merci beaucoup.
I love that he calls out each of these students in their native language, again, showing just how deeply he sees them. He next called out a student who was the first in his family to graduate from high school.
Eliasi Tonga Tukuafu, please stand. Son of Kalani, his mother, Eli's father, Finau Tukuafu, passed away his sophomore year. Eli's the oldest of five siblings, will be the first to graduate from high school. Eli's parents wanted him at Sky Ridge for better education and better influences. He first stayed in Lehi with a supportive uncle and auntie Mahe, then moved back home to Salt Lake when his dad passed to help his mom. In the span of several months, Eli lost his grandpa, his dad, his uncle, who he was named after, and two cousins from the Hunter High School shooting. For a while, Eli took the train from Salt Lake City every morning to Thanksgiving Point so he could attend Sky Ridge. He's been involved with football, lacrosse, wrestling, boys volleyball, and our Polynesian club. Eli plans to attend Utah Valley University to major in criminal justice in hopes of becoming a police officer. Eliasi, maloa pito.
Next, he called out a student from Mexico.
Georgina Diaz, please stand. Georgina is the daughter of Valentina and Carlos Torres Diaz, who moved their family to the U.S. from Mexico to provide a better life for their five children. They moved to Utah when Georgina was in seventh grade. Georgina is bilingual and biliterate, holds a GPA of 3.9, with a lot of AP and other college-level classes on her schedule. Through MTech, she will finish with a certificate as a pharmacy technician. She's active in our FCCLA and qualified for nationals in July. She works two 20-hour jobs at Marshall's and at Walmart, thus frequently needing to do her homework in the early a.m. hours. Her paycheck helps her family with food and bills. Georgina received the Eccles Full-Ride Scholarship to attend the University of Utah, majoring in biomedical engineering and biochemistry in hopes of being an anesthesiologist. Georgina, muchísimas gracias por su ejemplo.
And finally, he turned to student Lincoln Perkins, who had a unique connection to Sky Ridge.
Lincoln Perkins, please stand. Son of Joel and Summer Perkins, Lincoln's dad, Dr. Perkins, was the first principal here at Sky Ridge, opened the school, created a vision and mission of this school. Dr. Perkins wanted to create a school, an environment and culture where Lincoln and other students could be included and thrive. And that's what Lincoln has done. He has thrived. Lincoln has been active and involved in our unified sports teams of soccer, basketball, volleyball, track. He's a key member of our jazz and marching bands. He plays the bass electric guitar, the upright bass. He plays the, and he's also teaching himself to play the guitar, the violin, and the piano. Lincoln also writes music. He's earned a 3.9 GPA while at Sky Ridge with some advanced and AP courses. Lincoln is planning to go to Alpine Tech and also Utah Valley University to follow and achieve his music dreams.
And then finally, it wouldn't be possible. Those five extraordinary students from across the world and all kinds of backgrounds. Of course, none of that happens without extraordinary teachers. And John Wahlberg, the principal, took a moment to call out one of his retiring teachers with an honorary diploma.
Miss Harrison has taught in the classroom for 30 years, the last 22 in the Alpine School District. When Valerie was a young girl attending Kearns High School, due to family circumstances, she had to drop out of high school and get a full-time job to support her family and herself. She later attended Ricks College without a diploma. After a year at Ricks and a 3.8 GPA, she decided to go to BYU. Without a diploma, she couldn't. Valerie quickly obtained her GED and then went to BYU. She later graduated from BYU and started her teaching career. Miss Harrison, we wanted to award you an honorary diploma from Sky Ridge High School. So now you are a retiree and an alumni of Sky Ridge High School. Congratulations, Miss Harrison.
All right, all of that coming from the graduation at Sky Ridge High School and Principal John Wahlberg. That, my friends, is what leadership in education sounds like. Someone who understands what that day means, someone who can see not just a mass of students moving through, not people just checking boxes and going on to the next step, but people who have unique stories. You talk about someone coming from Haiti as a 15-year-old. I can't even imagine that, and then to be taking AP courses and scholarships and on through each of those stories, to me, is an extraordinary thing. And the most important thing is that while we have to have government to fund and make sure the baselines of all of that is taken care of in terms of rooms and buildings and supplies, where all of those stories you just heard from a very inspired and inspiring principal came through teachers, through individuals, and through people who were just determined to make a difference. And that's how community happens. And that's why even on a week like this, where we can be pessimistic about the politics and the process, I've never been more bullish on the future of the country. Big kudos to Sky Ridge Principal and High School, John Wahlberg. Great, great stuff today. All right, that rounds out our week on Inside Sources here on KSL News Radio. I'm Boyd Matheson. And as always, as you go out into the world today, make sure you see something that inspires, say something that uplifts, and do something today that'll make a difference.
KSL FM Midvale, KSL Salt Lake City. Listen on the KSL News Radio app and in your car at 102.7 FM. KSL News Radio, Utah's all-day companion for news.
A gun in the face.
Then all of a sudden they all kind of lined up. They pointed their guns at me. And this is the point where I thought, I'm going to die today.
Started 2 years of horror for an American in Venezuela.
They said, you need to give us your phone and get ready because you're coming with us.
I'm Becky Bruce, and I spent a year researching and piecing together Josh and Tammy Holt's story about their ordeal in a notorious prison.
That's when everything started to turn bad. We had another pound on the door. Boom, boom, boom. And there was the police once again.
You can binge all of the episodes of Hope and Darkness on KSLpodcasts.com or wherever you get your podcasts.